to deny that we're saying that men came from apes or monkeys is pusillanimous, if not downright dishonest. But how do they come up with this? We're going to discuss about the matter of fossil men and what is the present situation. The operation.
Now you bear with me while we work our way through some of the things we hope that will be interesting to you. And I know I'm taking a little time. But like Foy Wallace said years ago, he said, you know, brethren, it takes a whole lot longer to perform open heart surgery than it does to remove a war. Of course, the trouble with Brother Wallace was he thought every time he preached it was open heart surgery, but now. And maybe you think that about
then
me
taking
because
the
of
parts that do not overlap.
And a lot of you may be like the little boy
and saying these are the distinctive features of a man and these are the distinctive features of an ape. And whenever they find any fossilized remains, they put it somewhere between apes and men under the assumption that, of course, evolution has occurred. That's how they do it. Now, looking back at this, I showed this the other night when I just, in sort of previewing what we're going to do. You notice this fella is out of line. I mean, he looks like he's this one maybe has butted in line ahead of him. That's just a slight clue to what, when you and I really get into it, it develops into a most interesting situation with regard to fossil men. I want you to see the history of this. And what we're going to show here is that when you come up with this, this picture does not tell you what the data reveals. And you just check me on this. It doesn't tell you what the data reveals. It tells you what the presuppositions and the concepts of the people interpreting the data is. This is the result of their theories, not what the data says. And let me show you that. First of all, let's take reconstructions, for instance. Now, I actually ask an anthropologist on a university campus, how do you know what this one looked like, really? He said, it's easy if you know what the one in front of it looked like and the one after it looked like, it's easy to figure out what that would look like. Very impressive. Now, and if you think that I'm just joking here about reconstructions, years ago, Ernest Houghton of Harvard University said, don't trust in reconstructions. He says, with a little imagination, you can, with equal facility, take the same bone structure and put the face of a chimpanzee in that of a philosopher. And I'm going to tell you something, that's what the truth is. And you know, I don't have to argue it, I have it here. In the Time Life book on Neanderthals. And I've just pulled things out of there to show you that they're admitting that the reconstructions that they put before us in the museums in the past have been wrong and they've been misleading. They are not correct. In order to illustrate this in the book, they hired an artist. And what he did is he took the same skull and look what he did with it. He put the face of a man and that of a chimpanzee. Now let's read the small print. It asked the question, how could early reconstructions of Neanderthal man's appearance have been so wrong and is today accepted version of the truth indeed true? Nobody knows the answer to these questions. But these two reconstructions, prepared especially for this book and shown here in full face and profile view, show how widely divergent interpretations come about. You see? Reconstructions. You can't trust them. Well, now, this is the reconstruction of Neanderthal. Now, you see, Neanderthal early on was considered to be beetle-browed and very brutal in the idea of dragging the wife around with the hair, that sort of picture. Now he's considered to be an intelligent human being. In other words, skilled. He has aesthetic values. He's religious, according to their reconstruction of this. And you put a little hair on that fellow, you know. And you and I have seen people like that about us. And in fact, the truth of the matter is that Neanderthal's skull is larger in its capacity than the average European today. See, Neanderthal is not what they claimed he was. Well, how did that all happen? Now, let's notice this. Here's a reconstruction, you see, of two tool-bearing men and a woman. You see, a mother and a child. And this has been in a museum. Now, kids always get a laugh out of this. They say that looks like Dad before he shaves in the morning. But now, in the small print, now this is, I tried to improve on this, but this is not good, but the print says, typical of the misconceptions that have misled experts and laymans about Neanderthal. Now, this is in the Time Life book, you see. Are these three diorama figures, a nursing mother and two tool-bearing men, displayed in the Chicago Museum for many decades? It says their hunched shoulders, dangling arms, and ape-like postures are exaggeration at best. Most deceiving of all are their bovine expressions. Real Neanderthals were people of considerable intelligence. But you see, how many students went through the museum and said, "Well, it's in the museum. If it wasn't true, it wouldn't be a museum." You're going to find students talking that same way. Well, it's in the book. If it's in the book, it must be what? True. Yeah. Now then, let me show you. This is at least 9 different reconstructions of Neanderthal. You can get all kinds of things. But now, why were they reconstructed in that way? And the clue lies with this man here. This man here is Marcellin Boulay. Pierre Marcellin Boulay. He was the early 20th century's foremost authority on fossils. And he traveled the world to study new finds. Yet, it's admitted now that he created a badly distorted reconstruction of Neanderthal that misled scientists for decades. Now, what we're saying here then is at the very beginning, it's obvious that when we talk about how they come up with this, that reconstructions are made that are based upon how we think they ought to look. Now, I'm not saying that certain reconstructions cannot be made upon the base of cheekbones and that, but I'm telling you, much of it is so highly imaginative as revealed in the artist who produced those 2 different renderings to show you that the point ought to be clear, that reconstructions are misleading to people, and it's admitted now that they are. Okay, here's 3 different reconstructions of Neanderthal. Not Neanderthal, but Zinjanthropus. I'm sorry. These are 3 reconstructions of Leakey's, not Cracker Man, Zinjanthropus. And look how different that they are. So now with that in mind, I've tried to make one point here, and that is the reconstructions are misleading. They're based upon a lot of presupposition. And the evidence is made to fit the idea that, of course, man has evolved from apes. The presupposition of evolution undergirds all of the interpretation of the evidence. Now let's go and let's see if we can trace the story of where they say this whole thing has developed from. In The People of the Lake, a well-known, well-written book by Richard Leakey and Roger Lewin. And Roger Lewin has also written this book called Bones of Contention. And the stuff that I'm going to show you tonight, you can find documented in this book and also in the book called The Bone Peddlers that I have. But they say the story of human prehistory is basically about the transformation of a small woodland ape-like creature. We start with this creature called Ramapithecus. Ramapithecus. Here he is right here. Now let me trace this, the so-called evolution of man. From a little ape that they say is 15 million years old. Listen to the story. It's a very interesting story. Now, here he is, Ramapithecus. Now, they say that there were 5 million years between Dryopithecus and Ramapithecus. 20 million years old, this is 15 million. Found in 1932 in India by a Yale student. And the name is derived from a Indian prince in an epic poem, Rama, Ramapithecus, said to be 3 feet tall, found also in Africa. Leakey found one in 1961, fragments of the upper and the lower jaws. 30-plus individuals were found in Greece, India, Pakistan, Hungary, and Africa. Okay, this is the beginning of human evolution. Now, why is it? Why do they claim that this is the beginning of human evolution? They go to the teeth. Now, what happened? This shows you here that when they first found the teeth, this is what they found. They put them like so they would resemble the human. But then when they found a complete one, they found out, hey, you know, that was kind of fudging a little bit. It wasn't the same. And you can see clearly the difference between this one and this one. But you see, the basis of arguing that this is the precursor of man is based upon the teeth and the way the jaws are. Now, here are the admissions that Leakey made about this. Now, Leakey said, now to be absolutely honest, we have to admit that we know nothing about Ramapithecus. We don't know what it looked like, we don't know what it did, and we don't know how it did it. Now then, there was an investigation undertaken. There was an investigation undertaken by Robert Eckhart, and I want to talk about this right here because he wrote an article in Scientific American about this. Population Genetics and Human Origin. Amid the bewildering array of early fossil hominoids, is there one whose morphology marks it as man's hominid ancestor? If the factor of genetic variability is considered, the answer appears to be no. Now, what he was studying living populations of apes. And what you're going to see here is that he found greater variations within the living population than when he compared Ramapithecus with Dryopithecus, and supposed to be millions of years of change. And you see, he began to put together the kind of data that shows you the drift, the deadly drift of this stuff. Now, what did he find out? He compared Dryopithecus with Ramapithecus, made 24 measurements on a collection of fossil teeth. He compared with the range and variation in a population of living chimpanzees in a research center, and then he went out and he compared wild chimpanzees. And what he found out was variation was greater for 14, less for 9, same for 1. The point of it is that he had more variations in a living population than when he compared this, which was supposed to be a part of a great evolutionary process. And so Ramapithecus seemed to be an ape morphologically, ecologically, and behaviorally. But what did we say was the reason why they said it was a precursor of man? Because it was the teeth, the compacted teeth, and the jaws. And that's the reason why evolution has taken a turn, and now we're branching off from the apes and coming down into man. Now let's look at the devastation, how this was blown away. Now in the book here, in the book that I was referring to, Bones of Contention, the chapter here is interesting. I was looking at it tonight, and it's called Rama's Ape Destroyed. That's that, and I'm going to tell you, show you how it was destroyed. And then I want to read you a statement here. Why is Ramapithecus destroyed as a precursor of man? Because there is in Ethiopia, a high altitude, a baboon, Theropithecus galata. It has small incisors and canines, closely packed and heavy-worn cheek teeth. These powerful muscles. It has a short face. It's an ape. And to take its jaws and its teeth and argue that that's a precursor of man, we've got a living ape that has exactly that in it. No wonder it said in this chapter that Rama's ape was destroyed. Now listen to this. This is what, here's a man who worked closely with Leakey in the Bones of Contention. The clearest message of the Ramapithecus affair, however, is the power of preconceptions, which in this case led competent scientists to ignore the evidence of other competent scientists because the conclusions drawn from the evidence were at variation with established ideas. Already made up your mind about this thing. All scientists are guided to some degree by a set of assumptions, usually implicit rather than explicit. I try hard to detect them in my own thinking, says Pillbeany. We'll quote him in a little bit. To isolate those assumptions which are not articulated because they are so obvious, yet will seem so silly a few years from now. I am also aware of the fact that at least in my own subject of paleoanthropology theory, heavily influenced by implicit ideas, almost always dominates the data. The theory dominates the data is what he's saying. You see that? You see, you already made up your mind what it's supposed to be. And the thing that has already been determined is that men have evolved from apes. Let's go on with the story. Now, what happens in the next phase of this? You see, we come to what's called the Australopithecines. We leap forward to 1 or 2 million years according to their dating method. I'm going to talk about that tomorrow night. But now, in order to understand this particular part, I'm going to share a few things with you about the matter of the Australopithecines. In 1959, Mary Leakey found Australopithecus Boisei, and this is really Zinjanthropus, nicknamed Nutcracker. But in 1924, Raymond Dart had found what is called Australopithecus Africanus. 2+ million years ago, it was supposed to have lived. And then the argument has been made that from this developed Homo habilis, and so they go back to the Australopithecines to make an argument. I want you to look at this. I want to show you what happened. In 1971, Richard Leakey said there was not really two species. See, they had this divided here. He said there are not really two species, but one. One a male and one a female. The same year, Richard Leakey challenged the idea that Australopithecines walked upright. See, this was a very common held idea. Why did they walk upright? Well, because that fits the idea of this development, you see, from apes to man. But he challenged that idea. In 1971, L.S.B. Leakey challenged the Australopithecines Ramapithecines, Homo habilis, Homo erectus thing. And you can see these terms. We've leaped forward from Ramapithecus to Australopithecus, and then they have something on the end of it, like Boise or Africanus. He found a juvenile, listen, he found a juvenile Homo habilis at a lower level than Australopithecus. Well, then that meant that Homo habilis had been before Australopithecus, and you see, you got the thing messed up now, unless you're going to be willing to say, in the words of the old song, I'm my own grandpa, you see. You remember that song? Okay. Now, he found, now get this. Leakey found Homo habilis, Australopithecines, and Homo erectus together. And we say, we're living contemporaneous. Now, how in the world, then, do you have something like this, that you go up this thing, like, what? No, what he did, he found it like this, you see. And more than that, he found the remains of what appeared to be a circular stone habitation. And when you listen to the evolutionists, they all argue that you don't have habitations until you have modern man. Well, you got them contemporaneous with one another. And this idea that they're separated by all this. So now, the Australopithecus. Then let's notice the confusion that comes as a result of what they found. Confusion will come if I don't get this stuff out of the way here. Now, the Australopithecines were dated at 2 to 3 million years old, and Homo habilis was much younger. But in 1972, in East Turkana, Africa, Richard Leakey found the famous 1470 skull. That's on the cover of that widely circulated book, Origins. And boy, this blew the whole thing open. And the problem was, he found the famous skull classified as Homo habilis, but dated at 2.8 million. Evidence that Australopithecus africanus, Australopithecus boisei, and Homo habilis lived at the same time. And Leakey claimed 1470 is more modern than Peking or Java, which are supposed to be Homo erectus and dated 1.5 million years old. In other words, it's supposed to be a much older skull, and it's more modern looking than the later Homo erectus. Now, I want you to look at the confusion here. I want you to see where all this is going. Now, what's the result of this? What does this mean? Dwayne Gish said that if what Leakey reports about his 1470 is true, and if the dates assigned to this creature, to Zinjanthropus and to Peking man, are valid, then Zinjanthropus and all the Australopithecines and Peking man are wiped out as man's ancestors, and evolutionists are left with nothing. Now, if Homo did not descend from Australopithecus, when did we get our start, is what Science News asked when this was reported. And Dr. Alan Mann, anthropologist, University of Pennsylvania, said, we just don't know what has happened. There are no real theories. Everybody is sort of astounded. It just throws us back to go. Now, we've looked at Ramapithecus. You can't go to that. Now, you come forward to the Australopithecines. Is that a precursor of man? Let me show you something. This is mighty interesting. Solly Lord Zuckerman, for many years, was the head of the Department of Anatomy, University of Birmingham. That's not in Alabama either. That's the name. Was first knighted and then raised to peerage as recognition of his distinguished career as a research scientist. After 15 years of research on the subject with a team that rarely included less than 4 scientists, Lord Zuckerman concluded that Australopithecus did not walk upright. He was not intermediate between ape and man, but he was merely an anthropoid ape. Australopithecus, and that's Lewis Leakey's Nutcracker Man and Donald Johanson. See, Johanson was famous because he's the first American to find a major find. And they called it Lucy because it went back to the camp that night and listened to the Beatles song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And that's why they called it that. But now both of those, you see, are these Australopithecus creatures, is an extinct ape-like creature that almost all evolutionists believe walked upright and showed many characteristics in between ape. See, almost all of them were arguing this, but Lord Zuckerman, after 15 years of studying, said it isn't so. It isn't so. Zuckerman, although not a creationist, believes that there is very little, if any, science in the search for man's fossil ancestors. Lord Zuckerman states his conviction based on a lifetime of investigation. Listen to this. Bottom line, if man has evolved from an ape-like creature, he did so without leaving a single trace of information in the fossil record. I'm going to pass over. I have some charts here to just that reconstruct the designs and everything, and you won't have time for that. You've seen basically, though, that they've tried to bring this from Ramapithecus to the Australopithecines and then go to Homo habilis and Homo erectus and on and running. And what we've shown here, you can't go to Ramapithecus. You can't go to the Australopithecines. So where are we? Now, let me just talk about Homo habilis for a moment. I must submit, and this is Alice B. Leakey, that morphologically it is impossible to regard Homo habilis as representing a stage between Australopithecus africanus and Homo erectus. All right, let's come on forward now. Homo habilis, look at this. Now, this is Charles Oxnard in his book, Uniqueness and Diversity of Human Evolution, Morphometric Studies of Australopithecines in Comparison with Men and Modern Apes. A very scholarly work on the subject. We may well have to accept it is rather unlikely that any of the Australopithecines, including Homo habilis, can have any direct phylogenetic link with genus Homo. So where are we now? What's the situation? Well, what about Homo erectus? Ernst Mayr, renowned evolutionary taxonomist, one of the giants in the field of evolution. The Homo erectus stage is characterized by a body skeleton, which so far as we know does not differ from that of modern man in any essential point. The main difference from modern man are a more massive skull and dentation and a smaller brain, which may overlap the size of that of modern man. In other words, is Homo erectus really basically different from modern man? Now listen to Pilbeam and Simons in The American Scientist. Homo erectus found throughout the old world during much of the middle Pleistocene from 500,000 to 600,000 years ago is barely distinguishable taxonomically from Homo sapiens. In our discussion tonight, we go into a great deal more detail, and I've had to have an overview, but we've eliminated the concept of Ramapithecus. That's not it. That's an ape. You can't talk about the Australopithecines being a precursor of man. Homo habilis, no. And even when we talk about Homo erectus, is it basically different from man? You do not have this evolutionary development that frequently is put before the reader in popular journals. And before I wrap this up, let me talk a little bit about some hoaxes. The Piltdown hoax. In 1912, Charles Dawson and Arthur Smith Woodward found these remains in Piltdown, England. A piece of a skull, a jawbone with teeth, canine teeth, assortment of animal remains. In November the 21st, 1953, it was announced that they were a hoax. Now, Stephen Gould of Harvard University thinks that this man here, who was a Catholic priest and a paleontologist, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, that he was one of the culprits, and he went to his grave and never admitted to it. Stephen Jay Gould makes a very forceful argument for this. But the point of the matter is that the world was ready to grab this and run with it, but you have to say to the credit of the scientific community that they were the ones that exposed the hoax. But you see, many people at the beginning wondered about it, but when they found a second one, see, they found the first one, then found a second one, they were convinced. But even people today, when they look at it, say, I don't see how they could be convinced. It seemed to be that the work of faking this, they took a skull and filed it down, that it was just so obviously, crudely done. But one of the most interesting that I've ever read is the Nebraska Man. Now, the Nebraska Man, and this is called Herospithecus Harold Cookie, because a man named Harold Cook found it in 1922. It's a single tooth. And it was said to be between Java man and Neanderthal. And let me show you what happened when this was published. Now, here's a picture that appeared. This was in the London Illustrated News. I was talking on this subject in Lexington, Kentucky, where the University of Kentucky is located, and I mentioned that this appeared in this magazine, and I had never seen it. And so somebody went out, and this is really neat, this is grave, you know, he went out and photocopied this. And you see here on the cover of this magazine was a whole family of these creatures. And it was developed from one tooth. And what it is, it's an extinct pig called a peccary. And somebody said that this is an example where a pig made a monkey out of a man. What we're saying here then is, you know, that you have some interesting things about these kind of reconstructions. Now, what are the problems that we face with fossil men? Evolution is assumed, folks. It's assumed to be true. And when your evidence is found, you put it somewhere between apes and men under the assumption. Reconstructions have been wrong and misleading. And we must insist that the data upon which they're making these arguments is too sparse. And the obvious thing is that they're constantly changing. And now let me wrap it up and prevail upon your patience no more. What are we really talking about when we're talking about the actual fossils that are involved in reconstructing man and putting out a picture of a man's evolution? The actual ones that are involved in it. Lyle Watson of the Water People. The fossils that decorate our family tree are so scarce that there are still more scientists than specimens. The remarkable fact is that all the physical evidence we have for human evolution can still be placed with room to spare inside a single coffin or on the top of a pool table. You get that? The real fossils that are a part of the final argument. Don't have a lot, folks. Now then. Let me share these statements. Richard Leakey and Roger Lewin in their book, People of the Lake, say, if we were to try to piece together into a kind of composite skeleton the fragments we have of our direct Homo ancestor of about 2 million years ago, the task wouldn't take very long simply because there are so few pieces to slot into place. The product would be pitifully incomplete. A skull, possibly part of an arm, a couple of leg bones, and perhaps half a foot and a little more. All right, what are the admissions made? David Pilbeam. I know that at least in paleoanthropology, data are still so sparse that theory heavily influenced interpretation. And we've already read that in Bones of Contention. Theories have in the past clearly reflected our current ideologies instead of actual data. What you get is a picture of what man now considers himself to be, not what the data reveals about it. And let me emphasize that again. Let's look at the statement here. This is a picture of the man, one of the authorities in this, and let me just let you read it in a little bit larger letters. In spite of recent findings, the time and place of origin of order primates remain shrouded in mystery. All of the considerations of earliest primate evolution remain very much a matter of opinion and are speculated. Now, how does that go down when someone says, well, we've proven the evolution of man from the lion? I showed you earlier, in one of my earlier lectures, that you can take any organism you want, and I'll show you textbooks in which it said that the family history of this, we don't have it. It's shrouded in mystery. We don't know the relationship between this living thing and other living things. Do you get the drift? It's put together, folks. It's an interpretation, but the interpretation or the theories are overloading the data so that you know exactly where they're going to come out. It's not like we're compelled to come out because of the data. Theories are heavily influencing the data to such an extent that we have this kind of a statement, and this is one of the best statements I've ever read. David Pilbeam of Harvard University. Listen to this carefully. This is the bottom line on this. Perhaps generations of students of human evolution, including myself, have been flailing about in the dark. That our database is too sparse, too slippery, for it to be able to mold our theories. Rather, the theories are more statements about us and the ideology than about the past. You see that? That's what it is. Man has been led to belief in the idea that you have a sort of a self-creating universe, which is absurd. You can't explain the beginning of the universe without God. You can't even explain the beginning of the first cell. It's more complex than all the rest of evolution put together. And I told you the other night that Robert Jastrow said, when asked about why is it so important we found some kind of evidence of life on Mars, he said the reason it's important is because if we could just find some evidence of life out there, it would mean that life was more common than we thought. But if we cannot find evidence of it out there, he paused and he said, it looks like a miracle. You remember I quoted to you from Freeman Dyson's book, Infant in All Directions, published last year? And Freeman Dyson, when asked the question about life, he said, we do not know how life began. He discusses the theories about it. He discusses Oprin's theory, the Russian. Some people have embraced it for 50 years, and he said the only reason why people have accepted Oprin's theory is not because we have proved it in the laboratory, but because the only alternative is special creation. That's what he says. Now look at this. Paleoanthropology reveals more about how humans view themselves than it does about how humans came about. Yes, certain members of the population view themselves in this way. Because the data has driven them there? No. Because we've accepted evolution as the explanation for the world. Those are important statements. And I challenge you to look at all of when the articles come out in the journals and they discuss it, look toward the closing paragraphs to see what they say. They say stuff like this. Now then, I want to conclude. W.H. Rouse has said, therefore, it may be concluded that fossil evidence offers no support for any scheme of the evolutionary descent of man, either within hominid genera or from primate ancestors. It isn't there. And with a humorous Mark Twain, there is something fascinating about science, he said. One gets such wholesale returns of conjectures out of such trifling investment of facts. Very interesting. Well, I'm going to finish tonight. I'm through with that. Tomorrow night we're going to deal with the question of the age of the earth, discussing both scientific evidence and also talking about the biblical data. We've been here a long while, and I know you're all older. The question is, are you any wiser? Let me say this. Ideas won't keep. That's what Whitehead, Afro North Whitehead said. Ideas won't keep. Something must be done about them. You need to do something with these ideas. You need to determine in your mind that you're going to make a greater personal effort to become better acquainted with these things, to help others, to help your children, to do whatever you can to help information to come in the public schools and other places. But more than that, determine that you're going to, with greater determination than ever before, make a personal commitment to a stance in which people around you will see your faith in God, your faith in the Word of God, and your commitment to the principles that are therein. We need to be intelligent defenders of God's Word. We need to be out there doing what we know is right to do. And too many times when we hear things like this, well, it's somebody else's responsibility. 10 little two-letter words will help you. Put them down. 10 little two-letter words. It'll help you in your life, your daily life, in your growth as a Christian. 10 little two-letter words. If it is to be, it is up to me. Personal responsibility. Have these things impressed you? I mean, the matter that we've talked about and the evidences that we have. Have you felt good about them? Do you feel that it's good that these kind of things can be taught? Have you even admired the presentation of it? But that's not enough. I like to tell the story about in the ancient Olympic Games where they went into that great big stadium and it was filled with citizens from Athens and not Alabama, but citizens of Athens and citizens of Sparta. An old man came in late. As he passed the stands that were filled with the Athenians, nobody moved a muscle to give him a seat. And when he got down to where the Spartans were seated, they all rose as one man in a united act of courtesy and kindness to give this old man a seat. Now when the Athenians observed this, they began to applaud and give their approval. And when the applause died down, the old man raised his husky voice and said, "Oh, the Athenians admire courtesy, but the Spartans practice it." We've got to do more than admire the truth. We've got to practice it.